This is the fourth part in a five-part interview series with Ilya Maslyansky on Russian internet manipulation. In this segment, we will be discussing Russia's online interference in other countries.
This is concrete, tangible evidence of the power of misinformation to influence the public on a mass scale. And clearly, with a weapon as potent as this, you wouldn't just use it for domestic means. So I was wondering, since you finished your thesis a few months ago, have you seen any new interesting developments in Russian media on the domestic level?
So, in terms of domestic developments on the Russian internet freedom front, there's actually something very relevant to what we've been talking about here that is also very recent. So, LinkedIn was banned in Russia about a month ago due to its failure to comply with the law requiring companies to store Russian nationals' data on Russian soil, a law that I covered in sufficient detail that was part of the Kremlin's response to the mobilizing potential of the internet that allowed the opposition to contest the parliamentary election in 2011. So LinkedIn was pressured to comply with the law. I think it had about 4 million Russian users, did not comply with the law, and was banned. And, you know, you may ask what's preventing the authorities, you know, to go after Twitter and Facebook or also Western social media websites and services. My answer would very much be in line with what other scholars and journalists have said about this, that Twitter and Facebook are simply too big to be gone after in the same way for the government at this point, and that LinkedIn was essentially, and, you know, the fight against LinkedIn and the eventual blocking, so this is a first-generation control because now you can't access LinkedIn in Russia. The internet service providers had to comply within hours or days of the decision to ban. It was a legal decision to just go ahead and completely ban it. And so what happens is that, and scholars and journalists argue, as I was about to say, that this was essentially done to scare Twitter and Facebook into complying with this law, that LinkedIn, in many ways, was a safe target. Not a gigantic Russian user base, I mean, 4 million people is still a lot, but nothing as big as Twitter or Facebook in Russia. And I guess not as important because it was primarily used by, I suppose, young professionals as opposed to Facebook, which was used, you know, from, or is used from anybody, by anybody from teenagers to pensioners. Essentially, again, banned to scare them into complying. And this was essentially a show, a trial, a test to see if they could do it, get away with it, and not have people protest at their doorstep again, which, by the way, did not happen. There were no mass rallies that were organized by Russians to demand that the Kremlin brought back LinkedIn. So in many ways, this could be seen as a further step in tightening the screws even further. And now, not simply mass producing these laws, but actually requiring that all these huge Western companies like Twitter and Facebook actually do comply with them and, you know, follow and listen to what the Kremlin has to say. So in many ways, this recent development does not promise any positivity for the future. So yeah, in many ways, the decision to ban LinkedIn, which was, again, just a month ago, in my opinion, you know, doesn't show or doesn't give us any hope to believe that developments will go in any positive direction in the Russian internet freedom, you know, space, or in that space in the years or months to come. It's all very depressing, it's very scary, and it's about to get worse, in my opinion.
Right. In a way, this is even more pernicious than the Chinese Great Firewall model, where they just outright ban sites like Twitter and Facebook, because in this case, Russia is allowing a semblance of internet freedom by letting these companies come into their countries, but at the same time, they're also using threats to secure their compliance. So it's sort of like a win-win situation for the Russian state. There's been a lot of talk about how the Russians are interfering with elections in the West, like in the US or like in Germany, by manipulating the news cycles and polluting the news and selectively leaking information. Do you see any continuities between the domestic controls that you've researched and talked about and what's happening in the news right now?
I certainly do. And in many ways, the Russians, and when I say the Russians, I really mean the political establishment and not ethnic Russians or the Russian nation, have become experts in ways and strategies to rein in and co-opt the internet and social media. So, you know, once again, to sort of discuss current and recent news items a bit. So there were recently reports that found that there were troll farms set up in Macedonia that aimed to produce fake news to support Donald Trump. I mean, you know, we've been hearing a lot of talk about Russian hackers essentially electing Trump. I can't say that we should, you know, entirely agree with that statement. I think, you know, to a certain extent, there has been news cycle manipulation. And, you know, that requires a lot of scholarly attention and attention from journalists, which it has received. So troll farms, essentially the same model that I discussed in the Russian case, were set up in small Macedonian towns where young people with knowledge of English were employed to produce fake news articles, which were published on fake news websites, you know, again, to pollute the informational cycle and portray Donald Trump in a positive light. That happened, that was real, you know, you can go and read about it. And essentially, you know, people might be asking, you know, where did this come from? And in my opinion, this is already clear evidence of sort of Russian interference with the election, because the model that was used is essentially a Russian model. The Kremlin has acquired a lot of experience how to do these things and how to do them right in any cost-efficient manner over the years between 2011 and now. And, you know, who knows, maybe we will see them trying to use a similar tactic, you know, in the future to try and alter or affect electoral results in other countries as they should see fit.
So do you have any predictions about where and how Russian media controls might go next? What will the Russian media landscape look like by the time Putin's third term ends in 2018?
At this point, all I can say is that the United Russia Party, which is the governing party, will try its absolute best to stay in power during the 2018 presidential election. Authoritarians do learn, as I argue in my thesis, as I would like to think I clearly show with the example of the internet and social media. And authoritarians also like holding on to power and ensuring peaceful transitions of, you know, government to government within the same party, or presidential post to presidential post within the same essentially political clique of people. So should it be Putin, or, you know, maybe it will be another candidate, we will at some point in the future find out, the party and the political status quo will take any legal and extra-legal means to make sure that it is the party that stays in power. Putin is in firm control of the presidency and is going to stay as president until 2018. Very recently, the United Russia Party seized a majority in the State Duma, the country's lower house of the legislature, just a month ago, 5 years after the 2011 election. Now I believe they have an even greater majority. So, you know, with essentially a full control of the state's executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch too, because that's the way that things are currently running in Russia, I don't see how a development would somehow unwrap and come into existence that would undermine the regime's hold on power to such a great extent that it would really shake things up in 2018, especially given everything and in the context of everything that I've been talking about. You know, you have these internet trolls, Twitter bots, directly acquiring indirect control of social media news websites, and all these restrictive laws. You have that in the background as we talk about elections, presidential and parliamentary, that are supposed to be fair and democratic. I don't think it takes, you know, to be a skeptic to believe that things are bound to continue as they are in the next few years at least, or might even get worse, you know, when it's the same group of people, when it's the same political power structure that is controlling everything. So that would be my, you know, personal take on this. My subjective prediction, but yes, you know, no surprises for 2018.
You mentioned that Putin wants to maintain power at all costs, but what exactly is this power headed towards? What's Putin's endgame? What do you think he's trying to achieve by manipulating the media and manipulating elections in Russia and around the world?
So it is very clear what the government is trying to achieve by manipulating elections in Russia. It simply wants A, to preserve power, and B, to essentially brainwash people into believing that its hold on power is completely justified and that it is some form of benevolent fatherly dictatorship where, you know, Putin would treat himself as the father of the nation and, you know, the Russian nationals as his children that he is responsible for. So, you know, his goals at home are twofold. The goals are broad. In my opinion, one way of looking at it, and, you know, you mentioned them interfering with the election in the States, you mentioned them potentially interfering with the German election, you know, which is coming soon, the federal one. I think, and, you know, because you precisely mentioned the US and Germany, it could be that the goal is to affect electoral results in a way that would put a more, let's say, we can't really say pro-Russian, let's say less anti-Russian candidate in power into office in order to attempt to lessen or elevate the economic sanctions that were placed on Russia as a result of the Crimean annexation and the armed conflict in eastern Ukraine entirely or to a certain extent. It is no secret that the Russian economy has taken a lot of damage as a result of the sanctions. They are struggling. In May of 2016, Dmitry Medvedev, who is Russia's prime minister and is the de facto leader of the United Russia Party, de jure leader of the United Russia Party, de facto obviously being Vladimir Putin himself, he told pensioners in Crimea that the state simply had no money to give to them in pensions and that they would simply have to hang in there and wait until the government had money. So, you know, accidental or not, but his remark clearly shows that the finances aren't so great for Russia right now, given the oil prices. But that was, you know, a more, not as recent, obviously, the development in oil. But the goal could essentially be to attempt to elevate these sanctions or to lessen them, you know, to let the Russian economy breathe once more. And you have, for example, you know, Donald Trump, who will go and take office in January, and who nominated Rex Tillerson for the Secretary of State. And, it is, again, no secret that Tillerson is familiar with who Vladimir Putin is. He's met him. It is believed that they are quite close. And it's quite funny, but, you know, Tillerson received a Russian Order of Friendship Award from Russia in 2013, you know, because of his economic investments and, you know, because of his sort of investments, less so economic relationship with Russia and the status quo. You can find, you know, pictures of him shaking hands with Putin everywhere. So, yes, in my opinion, you know, this, the idea behind this and the end game is to allow the economy to breathe once more. Because, you know, once, and then again, once the public sees that the economic situation is improving, Putin and United Russia will receive all the credit for it. You know, so in one way or another, they're still trying to help themselves domestically by interfering in elections abroad. It is quite complicated. But this is what I believe, you know, his endgame is, as twisted and, again, complicated as it is. This is what I think is happening right now.
So that's a lot to think about, and it's a very uncertain future that we're facing, as you've said.
This concludes the fourth part of the interview series. In the next and final segment, we will be discussing Ilya's final thoughts on the issue and his advice to listeners. Thank you for listening.